Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the first Florida capital from 1824 is being reconstructed as part of Tallahassee's bicentennial celebration.
It is a double bicentennial. First, the city bicentennial, which was March the 4th, and then Leon County was created in December of 1824, along with like three or four other counties.
We'll talk about the origins of Florida A&M University.
In 1886, following the ratification of the Constitution, the Florida legislature moved to establish the two normal colleges. The white college was placed in Gainesville, and after much disagreement, the black school was placed in Tallahassee.
And we'll discuss collecting folk music as part of the WPA Florida Writers Project. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. The Adams-Onis Treaty of 1819 led to Florida becoming a United States territory in 1821. The following year, legislators met in Pensacola, the former capital of West Florida, and in 1823 they met in St. Augustine, the former capital of East Florida. To make getting together easier, the legislators decided to meet halfway in present-day Tallahassee, starting in 1824. The first capital, built in the wilderness of Florida, was not a Greco-Roman structure with a colonnade in front. Frank Terraferma is director of the Friends of the First Florida Capital.
The first capital was definitely not anything elaborate. We say capital. Actually, there were three log buildings built. Nobody really knows the size or much about them. I mean, one of them appears to have been used by Governor Duval like as a place for him to sleep. But typically, you know, we talk about a cabin and the cabin, but really there are recorded known three buildings. So they definitely were, you know, crude structures. At the time, they thought the legislature was going to meet in May of 1824, and they began on April the 11th. So they were obviously hastily constructed because they thought session was coming in just a month.
A reconstruction of the first Florida Capitol is being built as part of the Tallahassee Bicentennial Celebration. This is not the first time that the citizens of Tallahassee have created a replica of the original wooden Capitol building. In fact, it's the third.
So it's sort of a Tallahassee tradition. Beginning in 1924 for the centennial of Tallahassee, the Boy Scouts built a log cabin Capitol building replica on the Capitol, near the old Capitol. And then in 1974, the sheriff of Leon County for the sesquicentennial built a log cabin also at the grounds of the Capitol.
Doug Alderson is with Visit Tallahassee and the Leon County Division of Tourism. He says that more than 100 events have been planned as part of the bicentennial celebration.
But the first Florida Capitol idea, that's been kicked around for quite a while, because we did it in 1924, we did it in 1974. So it was a natural that we would do it for the bicentennial. And so there was a small group that couldn't find a spot to put the Capitol, put the log cabin. So finally they got the mayor on board, and he's a champion now. He is behind it 100%. And so they got Cascades Park, which is very appropriate. And that's being set up. We had a walkthrough on Wednesday to see where it was going to be, and we staked it out and everything, and it's a good spot.
Frank Terraferma says that the wood to build the first Capitol reconstruction has already been donated.
There's a gentleman who came forward who owns has a farm in Alachua-Levy County area, and he is a direct descendant of one of the first builders of the very first Capitol in 1824, Sherrod McCall. and he is going to be has offered to donate some beautiful lumber for the project.
The reconstructed First Florida Capitol will be a multi-purpose community gathering place to commemorate the bicentennial.
Number one, it's going to be community built. Habitat for Humanity is going to be the lead builder, but it's going to be just like a Habitat house. You know, we're going to invite the community to help build it. So we're the inside, you know, this is an ongoing project. We're, you know, still figuring out all the details, if you will, but for sure, you know, they'll have inside finishings. I know the mayor has expressed desire that the possibility that the city commission could meet there. So for the November 10, 2024 is the 200th anniversary that the legislature met in Tallahassee for the first time in the log cabin. And, you know, that's going to be that's Veterans Day weekend. And they're going to have a huge festival at the cabin at Cascades Park where it's being built. So, you know, there'll be historic displays inside the building that, you know, we want people to visit, you know, while it's open. And then certainly the festival is going to be sort of the pinnacle of the celebrations.
Among the activities held to commemorate the bicentennial of Tallahassee and Leon County was the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum held in conjunction with the Tallahassee Historical Society May 16th through 18th. We caught up with Frank Terraferma and Doug Alderson at the Florida History Festival in Kleeman Park.
Yeah, this is a third annual festival sponsored by TCC, Tallahassee Community College, which is now Tallahassee State College. They changed their name this year. And it's just an incredible event. So just look around, all the buzz of activity, the excitement, and it's all around history. So people think history is dry, but it's actually very living. And it really helps us bring things in perspective in the present day. So I think that's what people need to keep in mind.
It is a double bicentennial. First, the city bicentennial, which was March the 4th. And then Leon County was created in December of 1824, along with like three or four other counties. So it is definitely the Tallahassee-Leon County bicentennial. And, you know, the city and county partnering together have done a fantastic job promoting the bicentennial with events being held all year long. The city just held a mayor's gala. There's all kinds of groups are having events. There's a website where all groups are posting their bicentennial events. And, it's been an exciting time to be a part of all this.
We're talking in Kleeman Park in the shadow of the modern Capitol building and the historic Capitol building in front of it. Frank Terraferma says that the Capitol building has come a long way in 200 years.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, it was definitely a humble beginning from a log cabin hastily constructed. And then there was the second Capitol, which the log cabins only lasted a couple of years. And then in 1826, they began which was our second Capitol. And that lasted till around the 1840s. And then in preparation for the statehood of Florida in 1845, they constructed the old Capitol that we call the old Capitol today that still thankfully stands. And then we know in the 1970s, they created the fourth Capitol, which is the tower that we have today.
Doug Alderson points out that not only the structure of our state Capitol building has evolved over the past two centuries, our society has grown and advanced as well.
In 1924, it was during Jim Crow, and it was a very segregated event. The races were separate. They had separate events, and it was lopsided, 6 days for white folks and 1 day for African Americans. But this event, from the planning, we've been very inclusive of all factions of our society. We have more awareness of Native Americans involving different indigenous people, especially the African American community. And so you'll see all different folks take part in this and embrace this as Tallahassee today.
Doug Alderson is with Visit Tallahassee and the Leon County Division of Tourism. We also spoke with Frank Terraferma, director of the Friends of the First Florida Capitol. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org, where you can watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
Not only become known as America's band, but the most exciting band in the world. The incomparable, magnificent, fantastic, Florida University's 2100, more than just a pop band. Our theme, it never rains on the 100.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, scholarship on African American education often focuses on the Supreme Court decision Brown v. Board of Education and the subsequent efforts to desegregate schools at all levels, from kindergarten to colleges and universities. But Florida has a very interesting history of black education from the end of the Civil War until the implementation of the 1885 Constitution.
Larry E. Rivers and Cantor Brown Jr., two well-known Florida scholars, wrote an important article for the summer 2006 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly, in which they outlined the 1887 creation of the State Normal School for Colored Students, later known as Florida Agricultural and Mechanical University, FAMU. Rivers and Brown argue the strong black political representation by a highly educated cohort of men, many of whom were Civil War veterans, produced four black academies and influenced the creation of a state normal school that would train educators in the classical curriculum. As Rivers and Brown wrote, quote, "The tale involves threads of history drawn from abolitionist professors at Oberlin College, military schools at Hampton, Virginia, the far-sighted vision of Florida's only Reconstruction-era cabinet officer and the first African-American elected to Congress, tense rivalries between competing communities, redemptionist accommodation, and a bountiful supply of individuals of remarkable talent and education." End quote. The black cabinet officer was Secretary of State Jonathan Gibbs, a Dartmouth College and Princeton University Seminary graduate. The black congressman was Josiah T. Walls, who was born into slavery, served as a soldier in the Union Army, and rose to the rank of sergeant major, and was admitted to the bar in Alachua County. He served three terms in Congress, 1871 to 1876. The rivalries emerged between Gainesville, Ocala, Tallahassee, and Jacksonville, each of which established a school for black students. Respectively, they were the Union Academy, Howard Academy, Lincoln Academy, and Stanton Institute. The creation of these schools was all the more remarkable since Florida had no system of education before 1869. The individuals of remarkable talent that Rivers and Brown identify include William J. Simmons, Jonathan C. Gibbs, Matthew McFarland Louis, John Willis Menard, Henry S. Harmon, William U. Saunders, and Peter W. Bryant. These men migrated to Florida from northern states and constituted what has been called a cohort of black carpetbaggers. There was one additional migrant, Joseph E. Lee, originally from Philadelphia, an ambitious and polarizing figure of whom T. Thomas Fortune wrote, quote, "It would have been better for the Negro of Florida if Joseph E. Lee had remained in his Philadelphia home instead of carpetbagging in Florida," end quote. Finally, the Constitutional Convention of 1884 secured the victory of the Redeemers against the changes brought by Reconstruction, but also produced a black state college as a result of accommodationist positions adopted by black delegates.
Connie, the first efforts to provide education for black children and adults came through the Freedmen's Bureau and the American Missionary Association. As we've discussed in other segments on Florida Frontiers, the teachers in those first schools faced severe opposition. The four academies highlighted today operated with African-American funding and support, right?
Yes, Rivers and Brown note the combined support of the Freedmen's Bureau during Reconstruction era and the cooperative effort of the American Missionary Association and the Congregational Church under the name of National Freedmen's Relief Association of New York. The four schools named earlier built substantial buildings and brought well-educated teachers from the North to instruct students. Their goal was to train teachers, but Stanton Institute had a larger goal of becoming the normal school for the whole state. Stanton never achieved its goal of becoming a state normal school, but it did influence the creation of other black schools, including Cookman Institute and the Florida Institute, the predecessor of today's Florida Memorial College.
The end of Reconstruction in 1887 instituted a retrenchment of black political power and social opportunities. What were the circumstances that provided for the creation of a state normal college for African Americans?
The cohort of educated black men who made the four academies successful also held considerable power in the state legislature and enjoyed good relations with the Reconstruction governors. Their influence also extended to local politics and to the creation of several black newspapers. Hopes for a state normal school were not unfounded, and the four institutions vied for the possibility of receiving that designation. After 1877, however, Democrats instituted changes that reduced the power and influence of black leaders. First, they replaced black school principals with white educators. Only Stanton avoided that change. Following the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, Josiah Walls, William Saunders, Peter W. Bryant, and John Willis Menard called upon the president to, quote, request assurance that his policy of reconciliation toward Southern whites would work in the best interests of all, end quote. Joseph E. Lee took exception to the four, speaking for all black Floridians, and instigated a split in the black leadership with far-ranging consequences. The previously successful education efforts entered an extended period of decline, as did the political power of black leaders. The 1884 election brought Edward A. Perry of Pensacola to the governor's chair, a former Confederate general who backed the calling of a constitutional convention to rewrite, quote, the liberal 1868 Constitution, end quote. For African Americans, education was the centerpiece of their hopes for the convention. Former State Superintendent of Education Jonathan C. Gibbs stated, quote, we want increased facilities of common school education and the higher branches so as to be able to reduce the high rate of illiteracy which the last census showed to exist among our people. Seven black delegates attended the Constitutional Convention. Black delegates voted with the Republicans to overcome the Bourbon Democrats to create an education clause that provided for a segregated educational system and granted, quote, a uniform system of public schools, end quote, through a permanent school fund with dedicated revenue. The article also required the creation of two normal schools. The source of funding was problematic. State school funding came from the poll tax that was implemented by the same convention. Black Floridians would acquire the state normal school they had fought for, but the cost would be significant. Florida became the first state to impose a poll tax, which operated to reduce the number of black voters. In 1886, following the ratification of the Constitution, the Florida legislature moved to establish the two normal colleges. The white college was placed in Gainesville, and after much disagreement, the black school was placed in Tallahassee. The State Board of Education named Thomas DeSalles Tucker as the first president and Thomas V. Gibbs as vice president and first assistant instructor. The choices were important. The state expected a curriculum that would follow the Tuskegee model of vocational orientation, but in the choice of president and vice president, they got two Oberlin College graduates who instituted a liberal arts model of teacher training in the tradition of their alma mater. President Tucker followed the model for 14 years until he was dismissed in 1901. His successor, Nathan B. Young, a protege of Booker T. Washington, was expected to do the state's bidding and establish a Tuskegee program. But he was also an Oberlin graduate, with both bachelor's and master's degrees. He continued the liberal arts education program for the teachers until he lost his job in 1923. FAMU emerged as, quote, a unique institution and the nation's largest minority teacher education program, and is still tied closely today to the liberal arts tradition that flowed directly from their courage and their determination to call their souls their own, end quote.
Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Holly Baker has this look at the collection of folk music as part of the WPA Florida Writers Project.
The Federal Writers Project participated in several folk music collecting expeditions in Florida in the 1930s and 1940s through the Works Progress Administration, or the WPA. President Franklin D. Roosevelt created the WPA in 1935 to employ millions of Americans in a variety of public projects. The WPA not only built highways, improved infrastructure, and initiated reforestation, but also introduced important cultural programs, such as the Federal Writers Project. David A. Taylor is a filmmaker and the author of the book Soul of a People, The WPA Writers Project Uncovers Depression America.
The idea was to have writers and editors put together material for the WPA Guide to Florida. So there were state editors hired for natural history, for customs, for economy, and also for a section of the guidebook on driving routes. So they mapped out what routes they would have driving tours and described places along the way. The folk music collecting really came about later, and from the initiative of some of the writers who signed on to the project. Of course, many of them signed on because they did not have jobs. Many of them did not have writing experience, but a few did, and very few, like Zora Neale Hurston, had an idea of the cultural richness that was in Florida and that could be recorded. Hurston had worked with some folk music collecting and her own anthropological research. She was one of the first to propose music collection tours.
In 1939, author and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston wrote to Henry Alsberg and Benjamin Botkin of the Federal Writers Project to encourage them to record folk songs in Florida. Shortly after her proposal, Hurston headed to Florida to collect songs in Jacksonville and in a turpentine camp in Cross City. Jacksonville native Stetson Kennedy dropped out of the University of Florida to become the state director of the Federal Writers Project Unit on Folklore, Life History, and Social Ethnic Studies for the WPA. Accompanied by Zora Neale Hurston, he embarked on a folk song collecting journey through his home state for the Federal Writers Project. Hurston, an African-American woman from Eatonville, was instrumental during the folk song collecting expeditions in Florida. She acted as a valuable liaison between the mostly white Federal Writers Project folklorists and the black communities they visited in Florida, such as Belleglade, Chosin, Cross City, Eatonville, and Jacksonville.
Basically, the roots that people like Zora Neale Hurston and Stetson Kennedy mapped out for recording songs looked at places like soup kitchens, turpentine camps in the woods, cigar factories, in Ybor City and Tampa, people's homes in some cases. They were trying to capture the folk culture, the people's culture from north to south through the state. The WPA writers, they were looking for the range of cultures across Florida as Hurston had mapped out in her memo plan for the recording tour. They wanted to capture everything from traditional songs sung by turpentine workers in the camps far from towns to urban centers to Stetson Kennedy, recorded his young Cuban wife singing songs that she remembered from her childhood. So recorded other family members that she knew in the Ybor City part of Tampa. They recorded Bahamian songs, and so they gathered a wide range of people, some really wonderful singers, some complete amateurs. One of the poignant ones I thought for myself was a young man, James Griffin, in the Turpentine camp at Cross City, who sang about being detained just for not paying the company for the debts that he accrued while working for them. So I think some of the stories behind the songs of the people that they came across are really powerful.
Ray calls come alone. I didn't see Maury Rufus. Ray calls come alone. I didn't see Maury Rufus. I ain't got no money, and my friends, they don't even care.
Between 1935 and 1942, writers, historians, researchers, and artists working on behalf of the federal government set out to find America's folk culture, one state at a time. The Federal Writers Project carried out some of the most impressive undertakings in the history of folklife studies when they traveled across the country to record various facets of American history and life. As they explored every corner of the United States, they invited ordinary Americans to share their own stories. David A. Taylor.
The songs that they collected were sometimes the first time these people got a public voice. And so they may have been singing songs that they were confident of because they had grown up with them, or they had maybe even made them up themselves. But nobody had asked them before for these. And so I think the significance is both what they give us as the public for songs and part of life that would have otherwise disappeared, but also for the people who sang them, they gave a recognition that their lives mattered.
Because of the music preservation efforts of the Library of Congress and the federal government, we can still hear these songs today. They offer a glimpse into life in Florida during the Great Depression. Visit the Florida Folklife from the WPA Collection, 1937 to 1942, at loc.gov to listen to hundreds of songs recorded by the Federal Writers Project in Florida. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can also find us on Facebook and at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and this week, Holly Baker. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.